This is an interview for the Shoe Workers Oral History Project at Museum LA. The date is April 20th, 2010, and I'm with David Quinn at Acorn Shoe in Lewiston, Maine, and this is Andrea Lumgia. David, could you start just by giving me your full name?
David Kieran Quinn.
And where and when were you born?
I was born May 26, 1948. I was born in Springfield, Massachusetts. Grew up in Bristol, Connecticut.
And Bristol, Connecticut, what was that like at the time you were growing up in, say, the 50s and 60s?
We lived in a fabulous neighborhood and had great friends growing up. And went to Jennings grade school and then Eastern High off the University of Connecticut in stores. Graduated from there and with a degree in business and moved to Maine as a lifestyle move. Back then, a lot of us moved around. Our choices weren't so much economic. We just moved to places we thought would be a great places to do the next thing. So
Right. Came
to Maine.
Why Maine?
Oh, Maine was the ocean. We wanted to head north in New England. And Maine was had the ocean side of it, which was attractive to me. And
I had some family
in New Hampshire, so we skipped over New Hampshire and shot up into Maine, and just started up living up here. I came up as a teaching tennis pro and got work doing that pretty much right away. Did some factory work too, second shift in a mill up in Augusta, and my phone. I'll shut this in.
Now, what mill in Augusta?
Herb Miller owned the mill. It was right on the dam. It was the, what was the name of that mill? I can't think of the name of the mill. I'd worked in factories in high school. I worked factory work.
You did?
When I turned 16, I worked at making coils to dimmer units in a factory in Bristol, Connecticut. And I did some other factory work, and I worked a lot of jobs. You know, as a kid, you had a lot of jobs, paper routes and
right. Different
stuff.
What did your parents do for work?
My father is an independent sales rep working in the cosmetic trade, around doing the New York City, Boston, Providence, Rhode Island, Waterbury, Connecticut, working with suppliers to the cosmetic trade and matching them up with buyers for the stuff that they made.
Right.
And, as an independent rep, he drove Volkswagens and was home about three nights a week, stayed on the road.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
I have two brothers and three sisters.
So fairly big family.
Yeah. I have a twin brother. Lives in York, Maine, Peter. And I have an older sister, Carol, who lives in Burlington, Connecticut. And then it's Ed. Ed lives in Littleton, Colorado, along with my sister, Pat, who lives in with her husband also in the same area. And my sister, Florence, lives in New Jersey, soon to be in Connecticut. She works in New York City.
Wow, so spread out in three different
places,
really.
Yeah.
So tell me, you came to Maine and you did some factory work and you said you did tennis? What?
I was a teaching tennis pro. If you wanted to learn how to play tennis, you could find me somewhere at either I was at the Capitol Tennis in Augusta when I started this business. That's where I was. And I worked also right here in Lewiston at the indoor complex that's closed, I think. Yeah, it is closed. It's on Westminster. Frank, let's see, what was the name of the family that owned that? I can't remember.
So tennis was something you did through high school?
Yeah, I did that. One of my jobs was a caretaker of two clay courts in Bristol. So I'd clean the courts up. That's when I was 14 and 15. I'd clean the courts and then I'd start playing tennis on them as soon as I cleaned them.
So tell me, how did you get into the shoe industry, and what year?
Well, that's a fun story. I made holiday gifts every year, and for family and friends. When I got to a, in 1973, approaching Christmas holiday, a lady friend came up with the idea of a slipper sock. And I latched right onto it because I grew up wearing them as a kid. All of us did. And so I thought that seemed like something simple I could throw together. I looked around to see if I could find some that were on the market. And it was difficult, so I thought, all right, I'll just get some leather and some socks, and I'll figure out how to wrap a leather around the sock. Well, I called, someone said, I knew of all these shoe shops here because I'm in this town, I'm playing tennis with some people that own shoe shops and work in the shoe shops. So I called the Gardner Shoe, I think it was in the old Pepperell building, and some gentleman says, you need some lasts, which I didn't know what those were, but he said, come on over. I went over and we talked about the project. I sent down, I had about 20 people, and I described it. He said, well, we just have to do it. I said, we don't need every size, just so he gave me about three or four lasts to cover the sizes of the people. And I thought, okay, now what, so I used that to trace the bottom of the foot, but I needed a way to wrap the leather. So I bought some plywood that was about 3/4 inch thick, and I cut the shape of the sole. I traced the sole onto the, drew the sole on to the plywood, took a jigsaw, cut that shape out, pull that sole shape, piece of wood, right out of the plywood. And I have this hole, and I sanded the edges of the hole, and I sanded the edges of this plywood. And I wet the leather, and I cut the leather to be an inch and a half larger than the hole all the way around. And I took the leather, wet it, put it over the hole, took that piece that I'd cut out of the hole, put it on top and slammed it back into the hole and jammed the leather up so it had sidewalls, let it dry for a day, and I knocked out the wooden piece, and I had the leather was completely formed, it had sidewalls completely formed. So a little wrinkly, but got the job done. And that's one right there. That's an example of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that gilded
right.
Slipper sock. I can actually show you one. I've got some in the background.
Oh, neat.
I went to a cobbler who had a grasshopper, which is a machine used in the shoe shops to do repair work. And he stretched, I cemented the sides onto the, I put the sock on the last, and then put cement on the sides of the leather and cemented it to the sock to hold it in place. Gave it to a shoe repair shop. The guy had, the grasshopper.
Mm-hmm.
And then he stitched the 20 pairs, 22 pairs actually, for me. One single row of stitching around it with the grasshopper, and that was my holiday gift. Some people loved them. They got them and seemed to wear them a lot. And I went into, put my marketing business cap on and started doing research on the market for slipper socks, and couldn't find too many out there for sale anymore. So I needed some history on it. I called, I found there was an association of hosiery association in North Carolina, Association of Hosiery Manufacturers. And I called them up, and the gentleman on the phone actually was the guy who ran the whole association, and he had history on slipper sock production from 1948 to 1955. And it was like the wigwams and the Rippons and different people who made these things, and they sold for $1.98, and they were primarily in department stores, and they were stitched by hand at home from a lot of women who were working during the war, and then husbands came home, they started to have families, and they still wanted some work, and these sock companies would deliver the socks and the bottoms, and people would hand stitch them on with yarn. And those were the slipper socks we wore as kids growing up. We'd get home from school at night, and my mom would say, go put your slipper socks on. Get your shoes on. Put your, or if you're running around barefoot, put your slipper socks on. And where we all had to go to get them, at least I did, was that I had to make my bed every morning, which I did. And when I came home that night, my slipper socks were all, I kicked them off in the middle of the night, and they were down. So I'd have to reach way down under the covers to get my socks out. And then later that night, I'd kick them off again, and the the next day I had to retrieve them, I'd have to go through the same process. But so I got the figures on how many of these things were produced from 48 to 55, and it was huge. So I decided it was going to be all north of the Mason-Dixon line. So I took the population statistics, I found out the number of, and I said, okay, I'm going to use children and women. I'm going to just say that's who only wore them. And I got the population for rough children, women population for those years. And it was just about a pair of slipper socks for every person. That's how huge so I figured there must have been, people would know what they are and certainly recognize that I made it, that if I can get mine made into something, a version it'll be one of the nicest ones. And would they remember them fondly? That's what I needed to know. Would they remember them with the way I do and want to own a pair themselves? So I, to start the business in 1975, I've got my notes. 1974, in September through November of 1974, I brought the idea to Ted Johansson at Falcon Shoe. Ted was a fabulous tennis player.
Oh,
and
he was?
Yes, he was. And he and I played doubles a lot. We had a great doubles foursome. And we played singles and stuff. And he, in conversation, I mentioned to him that I had this idea, slipper sock idea. And he said, well, let's have lunch and play some tennis. I'll show you my factory. It was a Friday. So that's what we did. We came over here to this building and went to the fifth floor. He showed me his entire factory, gave me the tour, and he showed me why the slipper sock wouldn't fit in his factory. It wouldn't consume enough of all the different departments, things that he did. It was, and I could easily see it. And he turned to me and he said, well, why don't you make them? And I said, yeah. I said, sure. And he said, well, I've got, why don't you come in Monday? I have Camille Goupil, who's my superintendent. And Camille is approaching retirement, but he's available. He can work with you. So I came in on Monday, and Camille and I, over a period of a bunch of weeks, made prototypes and putzed with it. And then I took the idea down to L.L. Bean, just cold, the item. Walked into the old L.L. Bean, which still, the buying offices were still where the retail is right now.
In Freeport.
I walked up to the desk and I said, held the item up, and I said, who would be the buyer for this item? The lady looks up, sees the item, walks off. Some guy comes up, he looks at it, and he goes, that's not me. Just a minute. He goes. Another big guy comes up. Doesn't look at me at all, just looks down at what I have in my hand, and he says, where were you 3 months ago? I could have sold 5,000 pair of those. And that was Mert. No, that wasn't Mert Greenleaf, but Mert was an L.L. Bean guy. That was, I'll think of his name. Great guy. Yeah, he ended up at Land's End, too, working for Land's End. He lives in Pownal, Maine. So then I actually got a job I was looking for. It was a teaching job in Augusta of tennis. So I did that for the next year. But when the year was over, at the year ended, I called Ted back and mentioned I was really interested in diving into this. It percolated the idea for a year. And all I loved the teaching the tennis. And I still putz with it once in a while. Taught my daughter how to play last summer. It was fun. But anyway, I called Ted and we did the same routine again 1 year later. But we'd been playing tennis all year, off and on here and there. He'd come up to Capital Tennis. So. And he said, sure, start. We had lunch, played some tennis, and he said, took me back to the factory. And I said, what can I do for you? And I said, well, I'd just like to be able to call in, because I met a lot of his people in his factory. If I need some information, I knew who knows about the machinery, I know who knows about the threads, I know who knows about leathers and the buyer for leather, so if I could tap into that. And he said, yeah, that's okay, you can do that. And he said, you'll probably need some leather. And I've got some I think you could probably start using if you want, and it's in the back room. And he says, and if you want to cut it on my machine, second shift, that's okay too. And if you need some space, up in my storage area in the back corner, you can move some stuff out. And he shows me where that is. It's up in the back corner of this building, on the river, on the sixth floor, in the far corner. Just a great view of the foam traveling down the river every day. A big pile of foam we had on the river from all the way,
pollution
back then, yeah.
So that's
how it started. And I didn't get a bean order in that year that I was in the business. You'll know this story. The year that I was in the business, I was doing the tennis of the Capitol tennis. Bean went to Reykjavik, Iceland, and found the socks made from the wool of the Icelandic sheep with some pretty patterns that they knitted into the socks, and found local people to do the same routine, the historical routine of stitching the bottom onto the upper. So they were all set. So I needed something else to replace that. And I did all my cash flows and everything. I realized I needed, in order to survive for a year, and just doing this business, and to break even and come at the end, be even by the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And after deciding what a price is I could collect for a pair, which I think was $6.35, mm-hmm. I would need 5,000 pair order. And I'm at a bar in Augusta sitting with a vacuum cleaner salesman who says that Hoover vacuum cleaners are selling door to door. And he says, oh, yeah, I'm from Seattle, and there's a company out there called Eddie Bauer that is way better than Bean. He was partial. So I gave them a call, and I asked for, somebody said you need to talk to the new products manager when you call, when you're trying to, you know, so I said, I want the new products manager. And a gentleman named Cam Siegler answers the phone, and I describe to him the item I've got. Now I've cleaned it up. It's not this, not the, now I've got a real legitimate. It was the one I showed L.L. Bean when they said, mm-hmm. where were you 3 months ago? And that's, now it's got a bottom with a separate sidewall stitched to it. And there's a piece of foam, a layer of foam between, thick foam between the leather, all leather bottom and the rag wool sock. It's a fabulous rag wool sock. That's 85% wool and 30% nylon with 2% lycra spandex. So it's got some nice stretch to it. So I pitch him this product and he says, well, we're interested. I said, well, I'll send you a sample. Would you like to see it? I said, would you like to see when I could send you a sample? And he says, yes, I would. So I sent him a sample. And then, I provided for the time for this. And 2 weeks went by, and I gave him a call. He said, this is David Quinn. I sent you the sample. Did you get it? He said, yeah. I said, what do you think? He said, we like it. We think we'd like to put it in the catalog. And I said, oh, great. And now my office is in a little A-frame in Lovejoy Shores up in Fayette. That's where I'm living. I'm renting up there while I'm teaching tennis in Augusta. And he says, I said, how many pair do you think you can sell? He says, 5,000 pair. I didn't say anything, actually. I just said, well, except, well, I would need an order pretty quick to get started on this. He says, all right. And I get an order for 2,500 pair, which is my go sign. That's it. They end up buying 4,997 pair or something, 3 pair short of 5,000. I went out on the road and sold an additional 2,500 pair. My first retail account. Oh, that's another great story. This is before I even got the Eddie Bauer account. I picked up my first retail account. And that was in January of 1976. And I made about 133 pair, 135 pair of the product. And this head of the stitching room at Falcon Shoe, oh, she's a fabulous lady, stitched them all for me. She just went around twice. Fabulous stitching, beautifully done. And I went to a Cheshire Hill Mall in Massachusetts. Chestnut Hill Mall, I think it is. Upper End Mall, where they were having a craft show in January, where you'd set up between all the stores and things. Mm-hmm. And I'm setting up, and I got my 100, 35 pair, which I packed into my Saab 96, my Saab 99, an old, those old bullet-shaped Saabs. And I'm unpacking, and I'm watching these other people unpack their stuff, and we're all going to show our wares and see if we can sell, make some business. And these two nurses go by that are on their way to work with their coffees, and they see, and they each buy a pair before I even set up. And I'm looking around, nobody else has sold anything to anybody. I'm saying, this is awesome. Why am I? I'm off and running. Well, I don't sell another pair for 2 days. And I pack up and load the car up and head back up. And I think, well, I'm just going to stop in the Kittery Trading Post. And so I cold call the Kittery Trading Post. I walk in. I grab a with my Super Socks in one hand, and I go over to their sock rack, and I grab a wigwam, the wigwam sock that they're selling, which is the same sock I've got, I use for my Super Sock. And I ask who's the buyer? Who would be the buyer for this? Same routine. Who would be the buyer for this item? And Nancy Caliglieri shows up, and later John Reardon, show up. And they look at the item I have, and they say, yeah, we think we could sell that. And my price is, again, at $6.35 a pair. I said, well, how many would you like? He said, well, you don't know. I said, well, I got 135 pair in my car. And they said, well, we'll take them all. So I have my receipt pad is, I bought at Hannaford's. Right there where they have their pencil and paper area, they have a little receipt pad where you flip out the carbon and you fold, flip down the little thing and you write and you get three copies on the carbon receipt pad. And I made a little order. I brought the slippers in. They're all over the floor. Customers are walking around me. I'm trying to organize how to get the count right with the sizes. And they're fine with all that. And I give them my little receipt. I give them 30 days to pay. And I get home, and within 2 days, I get a check. For all 135 pair, and they paid me for more than I invoiced. Two or three pair, and they said, you didn't count right. And I was shocked. They paid me early, and they paid me more than they counted. They didn't take anything from me. I was shocked. That kind of assistance. You know, people showed up, just lined up to help. Mm-hmm. I got over and over again. I got it from Ted, I got it from suppliers, I got it from Wigwam when I got into business with them and people out there, and obviously Kittery Trading Post, and it's just great, yeah. Young energy, and people could see that there's something going on and just wanted to help. So that was...
So did they become someone you continuously supplied to?
We still sell, we've never stopped selling Kittery Trading Post to this day, and they're one of our major accounts. Now, Eddie Bauer, that's an interesting. It's the most interesting story because we actually stopped selling them by choice, and I have the year written on this thing somewhere because they got their business. They lost it. They zigged off in another direction, very different from from L.L. Bean, who was their primary competitor.
Right.
L.L. Bean stayed true to their roots even to this day. They're still outdoors, very wilderness, very fishing and hunting. And Eddie Bauer went more department store, women's fashion, and mm-hmm. they missed what people wanted in their business. They got up to 250 stores. Anyway, I grew with them. I grew as fast as I could grow the business. I grew with these people, with Eastern Mountain Sports and L.L. Bean, and I did some private label for these people. Mm-hmm. So the name on the item was same item over there. It had Acorn on it, and over Eddie Bauer might have Eddie Bauer on it. And if they needed a lot more and I couldn't make them fast enough, I'd send them the Acorn brand, and they'd ship you the Acorn brand or the Eddie Bauer brand. And Eddie Bauer remained my largest account for 20 years, which the amazing thing about that is I got it from the name from a vacuum cleaner salesman in a bar. So then I go out and we get up to 750 accounts. At about 750 accounts, we end up on the space shuttle, the slipper socks. And then within a year, we're at 1,500 accounts. We put on reps. And then we grow to 2,200, 2,400 accounts, and which have 6,600 stores or 7,000 stores. We're doing trade shows. We do the shoe show in Las Vegas, and now it was in Las Vegas, but we're doing the shoe show in New York City twice a year, and also the apparel show in New York City, the sporting goods show in New York City. Our reps are doing local shows, and we were advertising we're the longest continuous advertiser in the Outdoor Retailer magazine. Probably still hold the record for the longest continuous advertiser. We cold called. We wrote names down at shows. We'd return to your booth, and be hanging out with you for 3 days and say, okay, who should I be selling this stuff to? So we keep getting names. We call people. We grew the business and grew the business and grew the business. You'd think we'd find a bigger account than the one I got from that vacuum cleaner salesman at the bar. We didn't. We did until 94, 95, 96, somewhere in there, which is 20 years later. We started the business on April 1st of 1976.
And have you always exclusively done the slipper sack?
Oh, no, we started making sheepskin items. The next thing we started to do was sheepskin items. My first sheepskin item was I called it my OU. And the sheepskin item also has a fun story. Jim Jennings was the buyer for L.L. Bean. I was sitting pitching the slipper socks and coming up with the orders and just doing the routine with them. We had little people slipper socks and different colors and things. And he plops his sock on the table, which is called a fisherman sock. It's made out of sheepskin. It's just a simple sheepskin sock. It was lobstermen were putting them in the bean boots to keep their feet warm out on the boats and stuff. So I came back to the factory. We pulled that sock on a last and wrapped our bottom around it and reworked the pattern and put a cuff on it. And we had our OU. We call it OEWE, which got picked up right away by all our private label people and by our accounts. So we're instantly in the sheepskin slipper business. And then I need another item to marry up with that. Am I getting my timing wrong on that? Let me just check. Interesting. I may have started my toasters first. Oh, toasters were first. Toasters were 1982. I started the toasters probably with Eddie Bauer first.
And what are toasters?
Toaster is a slipper sock. Toaster is a sheepskin. Just a sheepskin slip in. You just slide your foot into it. It had a huge bottom on it with a big vamp. They were like mittens for your feet. Again, we put the acorn pad inside it. Acorn foam. Give it that huge comfort. And put a suede bottom on the outside. Now the item I picked up in a craft show. I was in, it was the fall of, probably the fall of 81 or 82. Probably the fall of 82. Now that I look at my notes. And the aspen trees were changing. They had this nice yellow color, and I was with a girlfriend, and we drove out of Denver and went up into the mountains, just as a road trip, and then we heard there was a beer fest going on at Snowmass. So after we did the Aspen, drove up it from the town of Aspen. We saw the Muppets with John Denver, and met John Denver. We pulled the car over and we said, "Can we watch you guys filming?" They built a little mining camp into the side of the hill on the little trail up the mountain in the ski area of Aspen. And there's all the Muppets and John Denver, and he comes over to the car and says, "Sure, you guys can." It just happened. But then we go up to Snowmass. In Snowmass, there's these crafts booths are set up. There's one booth with one table with only one item on it. There are all these toasters, these what I end up calling my toasters. And they were called easy gliders or easy sliders. So I nab a pair, bring them home, take them apart, change the patterns, mm-hmm. clean it up, put a suede bottom on it, which they didn't have, and between this my suede and the his bottom, I put my foam. Stitch the whole thing together, have a toaster. It's a stitch and turn item. So, again, Jim Jennings comes into the picture. So about this, I'm way along with this item. I'm going to put this item in. I'm going to start selling this item. I'm way along. I'm months into working with this thing. I get a call from Jim Jennings. It's about 5:30 in the evening. I'm still in my factory's in the basement here, way down in the basement. And I'm using, we have no windows down there. It's just the cellar. That's where I got cheap space, 50 cents a square foot. I had to move shoe lasts, bags and bags of shoe lasts, Bostonian shoe lasts were stored down there, just an acre of them. And we would just push them further away from us and just keep taking more space from the bags. And Bob Roy, the owner, he's a great guy. 50 cents a square foot. So, yeah, we were cutting down there. We weren't stitching yet, but eventually we ended up stitching. The whole production line was down there. We used home stitchers to make everything.
Oh, really?
Just delivered product to the stitchers. We didn't work a full year, the stitchers. And they didn't care. It was fine. We would take 3 or 4 months off, and then we'd start loading them up again. We'd start the season all over again. And if the business got bigger, we'd just start a month earlier. So we just add a month, add time. And eventually we're year-round going at it. So Jim Jennings calls me and says, I've got a guy here, and he's got an item. You know, so, it looked like something more for you than for us down here at Bean. So you want to see him? I said, sure, send him up. Bob McCabry. Bob comes up, finds me. I talk him, very hard to find us in this building. And he finds us. I'm by myself. Everyone else has gone home. And he pulls out the toaster. He pulls out the easy slider. The one thing. I bought one pair. So I say, here's the interesting part about it. I showed him, I'm working on it. His chin dropped. He said, how'd you find those? I said, I found them at Snowmass at the craft show. He said, you did? I said, yes. I bought them myself there. He said, a friend of mine just said, I'll sell a few of those for you. That's the only time those ever left his shop. And ended up in a table at any craft show ever. And I showed up, bought a pair, and he shows up in my factory.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. It's a small world stuff.
Coincidence.
You know, just small world stuff. And he says he's got a patent. And he's also showed them to Wolverine. Their slipper division. So the attorneys are going to get involved in all this stuff. And I call an attorney and talk for a little bit. I can see that he hasn't gotten much legs to stand on, that I could probably win this thing. And I look at how much it would cost. And I think, oh my gosh. He says, I'd rather have him, Bob, collect all the money than the attorney's fees. So I wrote up a deal with him, figuring for a 7-year period, so much prepare, and that's what we did. We kind of made a deal, and he collected probably about $25,000, which is really close to what I thought I'd end up paying for attorneys to try to win this case. But I paid it out over a 7-year period to Bob. Bob would call me, because when Bob was a hippie guy, he was still caught back in the 60s somewhere. He was out in the woods in Aspen area, building a house on an area part that was not zoned for homes being built, and he was working on this thing for a bunch of years. I think he was living in a bus. Mm-hmm. It probably had graffiti written all over it. And he'd call me every year. Hey, Dave, it's me, Bob. I sure could use some money. You got your figuring out yet? So send me a check. Yeah, I'll get right on it. I mean, we figured out, send him a check. And he never questioned. He didn't come. He had the right to come and check out our numbers and sit down and go through our books and everything. But we never cheated him, and he never asked him. I've always felt good about that.
Yeah.
So then we got our first other item, a toaster. That's what put us in the sheepskin business. And that's how it tripped the trigger for Jim Jennings to then do the next thing and say, well, here's why don't you put a bottom on this fisherman's sheepskin sock?
Mm, okay.
And then Jim Jennings went back to Land's End in Madison, Wisconsin, where he was from. Oh, actually, Sears. I'm sorry. He was from Sears in Chicago. I think he went back to Sears. So that's my, then we started making sheepskin items. And then we started, when polar fleece started to become huge, it was used in skiing first. It became a huge item in skiing. I can't think of the name of the company that cranked that up, but boy, they sure cranked it up. And then we got into that, made our polar pairs, made, especially when the printed material hit. The printed material, polar fleece fabrics printed were fabulous. And we're still the number one in prints, in fleece, in our in socks. We do them in socks, just socks. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so
good stories.
And so you've been right here in Lewiston the whole time.
Well, when I started, I started, I had that little office up in Fayette, and I moved to Central Avenue.
Right.
In Lewiston,
right. Okay.
And had my office in Central Avenue, and was working in this building for a few years up in that space Ted gave me.
Right.
And then I moved into the basement space. Still
here.
Kept my office, my cave down in the basement where I was moving those lasts. And then I started acquiring my own machines instead of using Ted's. I was using Ted's machines late at night. And I had a stretch. I had a stretch on Ted's machines. I had to get some orders out. I was doing the work myself. I didn't stitch, but I did everything else. And I had a few young guys who were working with me. They were high school kids. They were great. Dana and Mark. Dana DeShane and Mark Poulin. And they'd come racing in. And we'd work when we had to. Up in the corner, we'd cement them. And at night, I'd come in and cut the leather. Mm-hmm. And I'd skive it, the edges of it. And I'd, after it was... The leather was, I'd pound it after the stitching was done on the straps. I'd pound that out and cut the foam and just get everything ready. I started working. And I worked 40 hours straight. I was falling asleep on the skiving machine. 40 hours straight. Nonstop. No sleep. And at one stretch, I'd come in and Falcon ran three shifts. So Falcon ran all night. I could start working the machinery at 4 in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And I was still working the machinery at 6:30 in the morning. So, and then I'd work all day cementing, making the stuff, and processing orders or whatever I was doing at that time. And make deliveries to the stitchers and bring the stuff back. And, yeah, so just pure work. It's great.
And while your business was growing, you were probably at that time seeing shoe shops, the bigger shoe shops, reducing.
There were 19, yes. I say that the shoe industry probably started declining after the recession.
And
it started, probably started in the 30s.
Oh.
And slowly drifting backwards in the down. But after World War II, there was new life in this area. This building itself, Bob Roy started renting space in this building in 1964, I think. It was a textile that folded. And the textile industry was the first to really hightail it. And then there's not a lot of jobs. The shoe industry, there were 19 shoe factories in this building. When I first started, it was 19 shoe-related factories in this building. When I first started in 76, and you could run three shifts. People were hungry. There was high unemployment, and I could get everything I needed in this community. I could get patterns graded right up the street. I could walk in walking distance. I could get leathers, findings, all the parts needed to make shoes were right here in this community. It was vertical, had it all. And then but it was marginal, it was tough. Mm-hmm. It was tough business. And as employment rates, as people became more employed, it became harder to run a third shift. And then because people worked those shifts because they were hungry. That's where the job was. It was third shift, and then after that, the job was second shift. And then later, the second shift. And shoe shop work is not the first. It's not the most desirable work. It's tough work. It's hand work. And it's just people shifted and left and went to. When our employment rate got down to 3.5%, 3%. There was choice out there. Mm-hmm. You could choose to or choose not to. And the Walmarts and Bath Iron Works and other industries, Home Depot and Lowe's, picked up the service industries. Just picked up all these people, great workers, and they've done well. Hopefully, most of them. Hopefully, they've all done well. Finding new work. So,
what do you think makes your company successful? Amidst all the closings of the shoe shops and the decline.
We went to China to get all our product made. In 1999, the summer of 1999, in June, when we because we're so seasonal in the slipper business. Mm-hmm. We're like a pig in a python. We've got this big bulge that occurs, and we have to find workers, mm-hmm. stitchers, and beef up. There was nobody available in the summer of 99. It was all dried up, gone. It was the end. We were somewhat relieved when Sam Smith closed down Supreme Slipper. And I think he laid off 500 stitchers. Maybe I'm exaggerating. You probably have that in your history records. And I think that provided a pool that was gave us a false sense of security for a little bit longer. But as soon as that, meanwhile the unemployment rate is, economy's improving, unemployment mm-hmm. rate is going down. And there's so many ways to work. And people have so much choice. You know, we thrived as an industry when there was always somebody ready to sit down at that machine. If this person didn't want to, then someone else would. And now in China, we see, that's when we were first went to China, by the way. That's what was over there. For clearly, it's just people hungry for work. Mm-hmm. And they'd sit at that machine. If that person didn't do it, it'd be the next machine. It's happening all over again. And now in the areas of China that we're in, we see the shoe industry work is, again, it's tough work. It's tough over there. It's tough anywhere. And they're bringing in more automatics over there. The automatics are machines that take some of the workers' work away from them. They automatically reset the needle and needle positioning, and there's hydraulics, foot lifts, and then there's computerized stitching. Simple Brother machines that do pattern stitching for you, and you just put the item in and push a button and it stitches and you pull it out, as opposed to actually doing the hand stitching yourself. But it's still cutting and lasting. There's still muscle work in this mm-hmm. industry. There's still, and it's repetitious over and over. So when you get a Samsung and the electronic people entering your community in the China area that we're in, and they'll employ 20,000 people in one factory stretch, it's mind-boggling. I stood in one floor in a factory in China. Said, okay, so how many people are working here? 1,800. 1,800. And I panned 180 degrees. And I'm thinking at the same time, how many companies in the state of Maine have that many employees? Mm-hmm. I think there was only one at the time. MBNA might have been it. I don't think it wasn't Walmart back then, but Walmart now would be one of the big ones in the whole state, in one room, 1,800, one floor. And then I drive past the Samsung, you just keep driving. And it's a town, 20,000 workers are working there. And that's where people want to go. It's mm-hmm. clean, it's easy, and it's more of a future, it seems. But China will be making shoes for a long time. It'll take a long time before, but there's still a lot of people willing to sit down at our machines and mm-hmm. get the job done. So
I'm gonna flip the tape.